a poem by Rafael Campo. Not long ago, I studied medicine. It was terrible what the body told. I'd look inside another person's mouth and see the desolation of the world. I'd see his genitals and think of sin. Because my body speaks the stranger's language, I've never understood those nods and stares. My parents held me in their arms, and still I think I've disappointed them. They care, they stare and nod. They make their pilgrimage to somewhere distant in my heart. They cry. I look inside their other person's mouths and see the sleek interior of souls. It's warm and red in there, like love with teeth. I've studied medicine until I cried all night. Through certain books, a truth unfolds. Anatomy and physiology, the tiny sensing organs of the tongue, each nameless cell contributing its needs. It was fabulous what the body told. So wonderful. Welcome, everyone. So tonight begins the journey into the five aggregates. I kind of avoided this topic over the many years I've been teaching here in Seattle because, it can be a very arcane subject and one that the commentaries are full of their wisdom and their ideas and their views and full of the Buddha said this and that's not what he meant and argumentative. And I just decided to take this thing on and throw all those commentaries aside because there's a lot of richness in this. And I hope as we march ourselves through this series, you begin to feel how important this subject is to your own practice. But we're not going to get involved in what one sutta says over and above another or one person's views and opinions. We're just going to look at it from a meditative standpoint, and basically I'm going to give you mine, but I hope that you then filter it through your own and see if it has some relevance. Now, even the word aggregate sounds like, I don't know, it's a very intellectual and very sophisticated term, but what it is this. The aggregates are groupings of certain ways that we perceive ourselves. For instance, if you took apart a car and its basic components, you'd probably set the engine aside. You'd probably have the chassis. You'd probably have the body. Maybe you'd have the exhaust system. And each one of those systems, or those large chunks like the engine and the chassis, etc., you wouldn't keep saying, this is the complete car, this is the car, this is the car. You'd say, this is the chassis, this is the engine, etc. And if you look at the sense of self has groupings that are more than one thing, like an engine is more than one thing, but where we get caught up in thinking that these groupings contain the I, me, and mine, they contain the sense of me. And when you put all the aggregates together, you have a big sense of me, and then when you say, well, where do you exist in all that, you'll say, well, I'm exist in the body, or I exist in my consciousness, or I exist in my perceptions, or I exist in my moods and emotions and thoughts. In fact, the very basis for Western philosophy, I think, therefore I am, is based on an aggregate assumption. Okay, so we need to look at these things. We need to get an understanding of how the personness, just like the car, isn't the engine, and the car isn't the chassis, and the car isn't the body of the car. The Buddha used the example of cutting up a cow. When you cut up the cow in chunks, you don't say cow, 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 cow with every chunk. You say sirloin, tenderloin, rump. That's his. We assume an awful lot around these aggregates. I exist because I think. I exist because I feel. I exist because I have a body. We assume existence based upon these aggregates. And so for us to look at this, these clumpings, these groupings, and to start pulling them apart and seeing what they are, I think are extraordinary. And the Buddha, in fact, said that it's because of the assumption of a human being coming through all the five aggregates that we inherently take what is impermanent to be permanent. Because once we have an assumption of self or an identity associated with these things, then the idea level, the conceptual level, covers the actual experience of it. And we, above all else, try to persevere with the idea. We try to have the idea persevere, even though all around us, all of these different aggregates are forever falling apart and changing and in movement. So we stay away from the fragility of life by assuming the sense of self within it, within life. We take what's incapable of satisfying as satisfying when we, again, identify with this groupings, with these groupings, we, in order to stay out in front of the problem. To stay out in front of the problem is to run ahead of the fact that this, what I'm with in this moment isn't completely satisfying, but the next moment will be. Because it doesn't take long for you to have a body to realize that it's not going to bring you happiness. I don't think I need to elaborate on that one. I mean, there's some enjoyment that you get from it, but it certainly isn't going to be a lasting, unchanging, unaging, youthful product for very long. And then, of course, refuse to acknowledge that these aggregates are themselves without an entity, because in the grouping of it, it seems so assured, and we seem so confident that we are in there somewhere, located somewhere. So really, the exploration of the aggregates is the exploration of anatta, of non-self, of the sense of selflessness that is at the base and heart of the Buddha's teaching. In fact, the Buddha once said this. He was talking to his, he was almost lamenting to his disciple Sariputra. He says, "Oh Sariputra, whether I teach the Dharma in brief or at length or both, those who understand are hard to find." Sariputra replies, "Then, O Blessed One, this is the time for the Blessed One to teach the Dharma, both in brief and at length. There will be those who will understand." The Buddha continues, "Well then, Sariputra, thus should training be done. Concerning this body with its consciousness, with its feelings, with its mental states, there should be no conceited imaginings of I and mine, and no such bias. Nor should there be such conceited imaginings of bias of mine with regard to any external objects. We shall thus abide in the attainment of the heart's liberation and the liberation of wisdom." So when we have these aggregates, and the aggregates very simply are the body, physicality, which we will talk about tonight, and in the subsequent four classes, there are feelings, there are mental states, such as emotions and thoughts, mental formations. There's consciousness itself, consciousness. And what am I forgetting? Perception, thank you, perception. So, feeling, perception, mental formations, and consciousness. And tonight we're going to talk about the body. And that's why I read the poem I read. And it's important to know from the start that the Buddha felt the body to be a foundation on which observation could occur. He used it as a platform for discovering and often taught that the body as a foundation could be used to explore the other groupings, the other aggregates themselves. So this talk on the body is a very important one. In fact, the Buddha said that life itself, the whole world, arises within this fathom-long body. And if one is to understand or can understand the workings of the body and how it formulates the world, one can come to freedom. So the sense of understanding the body is a very important component. So tonight we're going to look at the first aggregate, which is physicality, rupa. Rupa is the Pali word for physicality. And know what the real definition of the word means, it doesn't just mean the physicality of one's own body, but actually all physicality, both external and internal. Now, I think that was interesting. I was just sitting here thinking, now, why would he call the aggregate rupa, knowing that that included all of the physical world, external as well as internal? Well, as I began to understand through my own meditation practice, that the external world comes into solidity, comes into solidness, comes into an objective, defined a sense of compression, you might say, when the sense of I, me, and mine comes into existence. And that in those moments when which we're not so entangled or ensnarled in the sense of I, there's a more of a sense of relaxation with the body, then the world becomes less formed, less concretely objective, less delineated from part to part, and not quite as differentiated. And we just think we're not focusing on it. But in fact, the world loses its definition when we as ourselves lose ours. So that the proportionality of the world being concrete and objective, when we are very concrete and objective within ourselves, that direct proportionality means that all of rupa is going to arise when we, our body, is very embodied, is very delineated, is very sharp and clear in its boundaries. So I find that very interesting. And you can play with that a little bit. Play with it a little bit. When you're not so clearly defined, a little amorphous, when your boundaries begin to permeate or just relax themselves a little bit, in times of deep relaxation, in times of ease, just look around the world. Just look out externally and see what the external world looks like from this view. And be careful that the mind doesn't start looking in terms of objects, but looks in terms of the space and objects. So it sees objects, but it also sees space equally between the objects, so that you just relax your view a little bit and look out. And you can begin to get a sense or an intimation of what we mean by the oneness of things. Oneness is not a homogenized view of life. It doesn't all turn vanilla on us. In fact, anything but. It's just that the objects begin not to hold their boundaries with such clarity and such conciseness anymore. And again, as we are easier and relax our sense of I, me, and mine, so too the world relaxes its view of being other. So the sense of other, or even external, begins to weaken. All of the sense of views and polar opposites begin to relax. So the body is, the Buddha made, is sort of the ground of our practice. It's sort of the foundation on which we can explore and discover the other aggregates, the other fields of grouping that we are going to be exploring in these 10 weeks. And it's interesting when you look at the body, because the whole history of our life, you can pretty much see, certainly internally, with our thoughts, our ideas, and memories, etc., but also externally, the scarring that you can see on the body, the aging process, the position of wrinkles, etc., hold the history of that human life. And someone who is sophisticated in that perception can tell you an awful lot about yourself just from the objective view of the body. And so the body holds us. It also, more than anything, though, it holds it holds the potential, and very few people realize this potential. It holds the potential of certainty. It holds the potential of confidence, of integrity. As I've mentioned before, when the Buddha reached his hand down to lay claim that his body had perfect right to be on the earth where it was, he was making a confident statement about himself. He was making a statement of integrity, of non-separation, that he could not be anywhere else, and that this was his perfect place to be, and that he need not self-doubt himself because he was here. And I think when we start embodying ourselves, we also begin the embodying of our own confidence, of our own place in life. And we don't have to look into other people's eyes with that shaky question of, should I be here? And if I am, if I shouldn't be here, or if I should be here, what should I be like while I'm standing here? That whole question comes from a kind of uncertainty of being able to touch the ground and know where we exist. To be able to touch the ground with certainty that this is where I am. And you may not like it, but this is where I am, period. And in fact, dealing with the ground of all things is the art of meditation. Dealing with the fact that we are all and all things are located where they are, period, is what meditation, the alignment with the harmony of where all things are and what all things are, is the art of meditation. But more importantly, when we begin to solidify our integrity in our perceptual life and our ethical conduct, we don't have to be in a paranoid state about where we are. We are not only are we solidly here dharmically, but psychologically we're not wishing we were somewhere else because we might be discovered or found out, because the lie might be uncovered. And so our feet are planted on the earth, come whomever, whatever question, whatever circumstances, without any flinching, without any hesitation whatsoever. And you can begin to feel the stability of sanity that locates itself here and now. And that instability of sanity comes from that sense of self-questioning, that ever-present sense of doubt, of lacking. And all we have to do is embody even that lacking, and we ground it immediately. And we know what the Buddha meant when he said that the body is the first foundation of mindfulness. We know what it's like to live without self-persecution. Because that has nothing to do with anything. Therefore, I can handle all of that very easily. And the body represents the intermediate link between the heaven and the earth. It's the reaching and the planting. And so it's with holy ground that we walk on, you might say, because even though in a vertical position, figuratively, that's the sacred rising up with our head in the heavens, with our body in the heavens, but with our feet planted on earth. And that really sums up what Buddhism is, it seems to me, that we're walking grounded, fundamentally here, sane, solidly connected to the earth, knowing, relating perfectly from that sense of presence, and yet not of the world, as the vertical position indicates. Grounded, completely relating, interrelating, but also transcending at the same time. And the body provides both of those. The body provides the ground of our being, but also the transcendence, if we understand it. If we understand it. The first thing is the understanding where the I, me, and my come from. And we'll get to that in just a moment. The other thing the body does is that it allows, if you'll give it a chance, it gives you a sense of where you belong, belongingness. Belongingness. And in this culture, there isn't a lot of belongingness. A part of the frenetic activity and restless spirit of us all is that we don't have a sense of history here. We have very little sense of belonging. I mean, California, above all states, has that feeling to me. When you even go, if you start heading east and you get to older parts of the country, you begin to get more of a sense of tradition and history. And if you keep going across the Atlantic to Europe, you get a very deep sense of that history, a sense of belonging, of knowing one's place. There's a nice poem by someone anonymous. I don't know who wrote it. It said, "My body, you are kind to sit and wait for me while I am away. I wander off, but you don't budge. When I return, it is to you." My body, you are kind to sit and wait for me while I'm away. It does, doesn't it? You sit, we sit together, following the breath, which is the first intonement, the first embodied sensation we have, the first sense of calling ourselves into the body through the breath. And very quickly, our minds are off in some other location or time or place. The body doesn't budge. It just waits for your return. And it will remind you of itself through its aches and pains, through its itches and sensations. It's here. Are you going to return? You see, it's a honing signal. It's like true north. And we always have it available. It's a tremendous, tremendous asset because of its availability. It's like carrying around a compass and wondering where true north is. We don't have to wonder. We don't have to wonder with an O where we've wandered with an A when our body is here. We always have true north. And the art of the practice, and this is important, I want to bring this in at the moment. We bring forth, when we enter the body, we must bring forth bare attention on the body, because the body contains, as I mentioned, the history within it, our history. And much of that history has been an antagonistic relationship with the body, because we've been told that the body isn't as pretty or as svelte or as whatever the word or adjective you want to use as it should be, or could be, or must be. And certainly when you age, you begin to feel that. As we age, we begin to actually become as the concentric circles move us through decades, we become more and more on the periphery of a culture that centers itself on youth. And so for some of us who age, we try to overcome the age with surgeries or dressing differently or some other way that doesn't allow us to be fully embodied. And many of us have had very upsetting experiences in the body, near-drowning experiences or perhaps abusive experiences in the body. And so the body doesn't comfortably, because of that history intoned within it, become a comfortable home base for us. And we can be very frightened about that. But you see, the body, even though it holds the mind within it, and you don't have to go very deeply into the meditation that when you start moving your attention through some of the body areas, the mind springs forth at you. It releases itself from the tissues of the body. So let's be unequivocal in this, that the mind is contained in this thing. That the mind, you might say, the body is hardened mind. I think that's an appropriate meditative assumption. It's hardened mind. And so as you put your attention in it, the mind springs forth. And certainly the history of what's occurred to each one of us comes in there. And all of the ways that we haven't lived up to the magazine covers and all of that, that comes out as well. And the shame that we have with it, or which is often held in the very way, the postures that we assume within it. All of these different things. Well, we can't be free by ignoring that. As we all now know, we have to invite ourselves into that and to see it differently this time. We can see it, I often think of it as, if you've ever been along railroad tracks, or those of you who are cooks on a hot griddle, where you can see the waves of the heat rising up off of the plains of the railroad tracks, or off of the, you can just see that sense of the heat. So too, when we enter the body like that, there's going to be the heat patterns, the mind patterns, that the waves of mind that come and spring forth from that. And if we just have the intentionality of okay, I can handle this. What is it? It's an emotion, a thought, a feeling, an assumption. Let me just come back into it again. Let me just re-own this thing. Above all else, I have to hold the intention that I want to re-own my body. We were born into it and we are going to die from it. We have to be embodied in it. We have to come back. This is the first foundation on which we can plant our feet. Know our confidence. Look people in the eye. Look life in the eye. And so we need a summation. It doesn't matter what your body shape looks like. There's nothing wrong with you. I mean, sometimes we can get even a glimpse that there's nothing wrong with our minds. Because, you know, they are what they are. Uncontrollable heresy. But that's okay. So we get a sense very quickly that we can't control our thoughts. But our bodies. There's something wrong with me in this one. And I prayed it across all the screens of the featured articles, the movies. Or what? The point 0.001% of the population and what they look like? What does that have to do with anything? How many of us have the luxury of going to the gym 5 times a week? And being able to even think about carving our bodies in that way? And are they even need to be? You see, we have to put all that stuff aside. Throw it out. Long since. I mean, I had an elderly woman who's my age, not elderly, she's... She's not elderly. She said, well, men are lucky. They get better looking when they get old. I said, that's fine, but if you're not on the market for something, what do you care whether you get better looking or not? If you're not out there parading, it was fine when you were looking for a spouse, maybe. But I'm not looking for that. So who cares? I mean, how much satisfaction do we need the public to respond here? How much satisfaction do we need inwardly for ourselves? And so when we place bare attention, just the willingness to see honestly. Now listen, how many of you can trust yourself to be honest with what you see? To be fully open and not to rationalize or deny why you are in this shape? Not very many of you. You would have all kinds of judgment associated with the body. And so we have to bring in a specialty, a specialist. Dr. Bare Attention. And let that govern what we see, because we want to see the judgment associated with this. We want to look not from the judgment, but to the judgment. We don't want to co-opt the judgment and add more judgment to it. We want to see the judgment. We want to see what's there. And unless we have absolute bare attention, we're going to fall into the very deep embedded aversion that most of us hold in relationship to this physicality. Trusting. So we see everything through the filter of I, me, and mine. Now, it's very interesting, this sense of how we get I, me, and mine from this. It's not obvious. I mean, if you look at some of the, when you start entering the body, you'll see many sensations, some of which are pleasant, but most of them are not so pleasant. Itches and aches, pains. And so we have a pain in the knee. We have pain. Right? And somehow, that pain turns into I have pain. But where did the I come from? Where is the I that's associated with the pain? It's not clear where the I is associated with the pain. Let me show you something. If each of you will just look at your hand. Now just see what you see with all the assumptions of it being my hand. Okay, you know it well. You've used it throughout your life. You have a history with it. It's not an unfamiliar appendage. So get a sense of that. Now close your eyes and embody the experience of what you just saw, and do not allow the concept of hand or I, me, and mine to be there. Just feel the inward experience, physicality of the hand. The fingers, the palms, the thumb. Now is that hand? Don't keep bringing back the image. Just is that hand investigating the experience directly, free of the concept? It could be anything. And it certainly doesn't have a my associated with it. Now, very gently, open your eyes and look at your hand again. Now, the image and the sense of personal attachment to it, of course, comes back. But soften your eyes so that you see color and shape. So that hand is still there, but it comes to the background. Into the foreground comes just color and shape. And there may be an experience, if you do this with enough quietude and enough relaxation, that you, what is that now? What is it that I'm looking at? Or whose is it? Whose is that? What is that? What is that thing? This then is the body at a more primal level, before the sense of ownership, before the sense of indulgence. Where does that indulgence come from? It comes from investing in an attached view to the body. That it represents me and my display to the world. And so the assumption is that I'm in here, in the body, somewhere. Feel like I'm in here somewhere. And that this thing is kind of like what I have to carry around. Part of the organism of self, and that everything outside of that is external. Now, I'd like you to listen to this. This is Douglas Harding's On Having No Head. I just want to read a few paragraphs, and I think it's worthwhile, so just bear with me. The best day of my life, my rebirth day, so to speak, was when I found I had no head. This is not a literary gambit, a witticism designed to arouse interest at any cost. I mean it all seriously. I had no head. It was when I was 33 that I made the discovery. Though it certainly came out of the blue, it did so in response to an urgent inquiry. I had for several months been absorbed in the question, what am I? The fact that I happened to be walking in the Himalayas at the time probably had little to do with it. Though in that country, unusual states of mind are said to come more easily. However that may be, a very clear, still day and a view from the ridge where I stood over misty blue valleys to the highest mountain range in the world made a setting worthy of the grandest vision. What actually happened was something absurdly simple and unspectacular. Just for the moment, I stopped thinking. Reason and imagination and all mental chatter died down. For once, words really failed me. I forgot my name, my humanness, my thingness, all that could be called me or mine. Past and future dropped away. It was as if I had been born that instant, brand new, mindless, innocent of all memories. There existed only the now, the present moment, and what was clearly given in it. To look was enough, and what I found was khaki trouser legs terminating downward in a pair of brown shoes. Khaki sleeves terminating sideways in a pair of pink hands, and a khaki shirt front terminating upwards, absolutely nothing whatever, certainly not a head. It took me no time at all to notice that this nothing, this hole where a head should have been, was no ordinary vacancy, no mere nothing. On the contrary, it was very much occupied. It was a vast emptiness, vastly filled. A nothing that found room for everything. Room for the grass, the trees, the distant hills, and far above them snow peaks like a row of angular clouds riding the blue sky. I had lost a head and gained a world. It was all, quite literally, breathtaking. I seemed to stop breathing altogether, absorbed in the given. Here it was, this superb scene, brightly shining in the clear air, alone and unsupported, mysteriously suspended in the void, and this was the real miracle, the wonder and the light, utterly free of me, unsustained by any observer. Its total presence was my total absence, body and soul, lighter than air, clearer than glass, altogether released from myself. I was nowhere to be found. Now, if you just look out for a moment from this body, immediately the assumption of differentiation of where the sight comes from. The vortex is here where I stand. And the world is the rectangular vision of everything that's included within that. But what if the sense of you was no more distinct than what you were seeing? Therefore, there wouldn't be a vortex. There wouldn't be a center. There wouldn't be an object in which was seeing. What was being seen would be just part of the seeing. The seer would be just part of the seeing on having no head. What if the world was just like this? Not just like this from where I see, but just like this, period. You may get an inkling. You may get a sense of how deeply embedded first the assumption of I, me, and mine makes the world seem as if it's all coming into the organism, all coming and derived from a sense of I. And you may get a little space from that from time to time, where you can begin to see just what's seen. The Buddha said, in the seen, there is just what is seen. On having no head, in the seeing, there is just what is seen. So in our meditation, we begin to enter the body through the breath. The breath is the pathway to the understanding of how this body seems to incorporate a sense of me, the encasing, the armor of the sense of me. It holds or seems to hold the outline of what we've always taken to be our name and story. And our name and story continues to tape itself throughout what we see in our life. That tape continues to play itself again and again. So the meditator enters the body and begins to investigate what this body is. Not assuming any sense of ownership of the body, he or she looks into the body with as much bare attention and sees whatever it is there is to see. And what they begin to see is you begin to see mind coming at you, physicality, but is physicality dense? Is it a dense thing? Or does it have a lot of space in it? Even when we were doing that simple exercise of feeling our hand, if you just go back to it a second, you'll notice that it isn't dense. When you enter the aliveness of your hand, the hand is not a package density. It has a lot of space in it. In fact, mostly it's space. It's just when we look out that it seems so dense and compacted. So we also learn about the nature of the body in terms of its experience. And in fact, science will tell you that all of matter is mostly space. We'll also begin to realize and see the patterns of mind that drive us when we enter the body. The impatience we have with ourselves. The irritation, the annoyance, all contained within the very fabric of the cells of the body. Now, we're not trying in any way to distance ourselves from the body. In fact, the meditation is to fully embody ourselves. We're not pitting spirit versus the body. It's not the profane and the sacred. And believe me, there are whole cultures that do just that. I was watching the movie Osama about an Afghani, a little girl who made herself up to be to look like a little boy so that she could get a job and support her family. And she was discovered. And the whole way, if it's accurate, and I assume it is, the Taliban held that culture And all from a repressed sense of sexuality, really. Covering up every inch of the female's body. So what? So that the men wouldn't be allured? Because it's repressed sexuality. And whole spiritual traditions can come from that sense of repressed sexuality, where they try to separate themselves out, separate themselves off, cut themselves away from those tendencies of mine. Well, now, I don't need to say this to you, but that's hogwash. We embody ourselves and everything that's in us. We don't take anything. We don't turn away from anything. We look at everything. Everything is open for view. And when everything is open for view, we're not being driven out of the body, but we come fully into the body, accepting it and all of its passions and its wantings fully, with the understanding we're going to explore it, not assume it's fact. Not assume it is a given fact. Don't assume anything in this meditation, especially around the body. When you enter the body, don't assume it's fact. Assume the question, what is this thing? And let the question breed the sense of discovery anew. So much of the difficulty and meditation is seeing it new, seeing it fresh, seeing it as it actually is, seeing it as it actually is without a head. Because the head keeps saying, oh, I've seen this before, I've done this, I know what a hand is. What's he telling me to look at a hand? I've lived with a hand 57 years. There's nothing new to see about it. And we begin to discover how the mind and matter condition one another. How mind conditions matter. That is when, for instance, when the mind is anxious, a mental state, the body gets tense. Mind conditioning matter. And matter conditions mind. Physically, when we're sick, that's a physical sensation of sickness, our mind becomes dull and lethargic. Or, physically feeling cold, our mind desires warmth. So, mind conditions matter, matter conditions mind. Mind conditions mind. For example, you go outside and physically feel cold. That's matter. That conditions the mental response of aversion to the cold. The mental response of aversion to the cold brings forth a thought that says, I'm going to go back inside and seek warmth. The aversion response, which is mind, conditions the desire to go back inside where it's warm. And finally, matter conditions matter. For instance, the food we eat, that affects the body. The food we eat, physicality, affects the form, physicality. So mind affects mind, mind affects matter. Matter affects mind, and matter affects matter. And so when we enter the body, we're entering a world of seeing clearly how this thing has a mechanical conditioned response. One thing affecting another, which affects it back again to the mind, which affects back again to the body. All held within the tensions. All held within the memory. All held within the association. And then as we enter the body, we also see the effects of aging. We understand the impermanence of the body. We feel it. We feel it in movement. Entering the body, you feel it in movement. You feel it in a vibrational movement. Things changing forever. Nothing staying static or the same. And that will bring up, inevitably, the fact that this body is going to die. Sometimes people who are on their deathbed would look at me and say, Am I getting better? Am I going to get better? And I would say to them, what is your body saying to you? Does your body tell you you're getting better? I let the body teach them. And almost without exception, somewhere in the dying process, the body will show you irreversibly, that it's not going to get better, that aging is not going to be reversed, that this is a one-way road we're on, and that the urgency to discover ourselves and to find that equanimity so that we can be fully embodied, not differentiated, but fully embodied, so that we realize that illness and health are really the birthright of this organism, is not health. It fluctuates between moments of sickness and moments of health, and that neither defines what the body is. You know, I watch old movies. Sometimes people back in the 1920s and 1930s, and they're all young and vibrant and so full of vitality. And then you realize that everybody in that movie is dead. Everyone. All of them. And you bring the reel of that movie forward 90 years, and you see the vibrancy of youth these days, and you remember your own vibrancy. And you realize that the urgency of discovering what this body is and harmonizing with however it moves is essential for our well-being and essential for self-discovery. Can we all sit for a minute or two? So if there are any questions or comments, I'd be happy to. When you're in social situations, you find it hard to be in your body?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. It's possible to do that when you are in social situations, but it's very difficult. And the reason is that we keep giving away our empowerment to those who are around. We keep saying not that we are grounded, that here we stand, which is what the talk was about, but how do you want me to stand, and how do you want me to be? We look for the others for our empowerment. We look for the others for the ground of our own being. And through that sense of interpreting other people's eyes and expressions for how they are seeing me, and then adjusting inwardly to fit their expectations, we lose the ground of our own being. So but you ask, is it possible? And I say, yes, it's very possible. But let's start by first embodying the body, getting comfortable where we are, because you can't, in the middle of a social engaged interaction, embody yourself because you just want to, when you have stayed away from your body because it represents certain negative images, etc., before that. To enter the body, you're going to enter all the backlog of feelings about it. So if we enter it now, it'll be a much more comfortable environment for us to enter in social situations. When you're in social situations, you'll learn, when you learn to abide in your integrity, which is what I spoke about earlier in the talk, where you're not looking for other people for self-confirmation, where you're not looking for other people for anything really, but you're not kind of the hell with them attitude either. You're very open. You're just not going to lose your ground by others. And it's not an objection. It's not a holding fast. It's not a screw you, I'm here and you're not going to get me. It's not that. It's a lightness. It's an open. It's an airing. It's just knowing the sanity of your own being so that you don't lose the reference, the plumb line of your own experience from other people's interaction with you. And that's not their fault. You're giving yourself away. You see? So when you learn how to hold that, you can then go into a group situation like I'm speaking now from that plumb line. I'm not losing myself thinking, what is he thinking of this answer? What are you thinking of this answer? And we can just, okay, let's just let the natural spontaneous quality of each of our presence be enough joy for each of us. I was at the retreat last week, and the image that came to mind, I was up on top of the dining hall looking down on the road, and there were three retreatants just after the retreat had ended and we had broken silence that were grouped, and they were laughing. And it reminded me of the old Zen paintings of a mountain and a mountain stream, and then three people in the valley, and they were just expressing nature, the natural expression of joy in their interaction. And I thought, you know, that's it, right there in front of me. Just living, the joy of living, the joy of connecting, the joy of affirming the ground we live on, affirming life through happiness, through the joie de vivre, the joy of being. And where have we lost that? Where have we got blindsided in all of that? You see? Well, it starts in the body. It starts right here. By telling us that this isn't the right vehicle for me. I got a 47 Chevy, and I always wanted a Cadillac, of newer vintage. And then carrying that begrudgment around with us for 50 years. And everybody that sees a Chevrolet, damn. See the USA. You see, it's not, you know, it's not. That's okay. What's it like? I mean, some of us have had whole histories of eating disorders, bulimia and anorexia. Why? Because of that very thing. Because of the image. But when you embody it, where is the image? What is the image? You see the importance of this discovery? Literally, your sanity depends upon it. How are you going to hold literally the ground of yourself when the waves of expectation and thought will break over you in every interaction? What is she thinking of me? Oh my God, that was a silly thing for me to say. What am I doing? Until we break the foothold that other people have over our own empowerment, over our own plumb line of being. I don't care. Not I don't care. It's I don't care. I don't care, in fact, not an aversion. I don't care because there's nothing to care about. Because whatever you're thinking is as much insanity as what I'm thinking. Why should I allow your insanity in to guide me? Yes.
So it seems when you talk about the joie de vivre and other things, that's really easier for me to comprehend and to sort of embody. But physical pain is on the other side of that. And although when I experience it, sometimes it actually strengthens my practice.
Yes. 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 Yes, I certainly can. The question is, in terms of the embodiment of one's experience in the joie de vivre, where the joy of being can be grasped pretty easily, and we can move towards that. But what about pain? What about the aversive quality of physical pain? How do we work with that one? And at times in one's practice, you can begin to approach that, but it always seems to hold us in a very abject view and disturbing view of an anxiousness. Okay. First of all, you want to be very patient with this. The importance of patience can't be underestimated. We have to begin to understand how the sense of me separates it out from pain, from unpleasant sensations. And we'll talk about this in the next talk on the aggregate of feeling. But just to give you a preview, if the feeling tone, the unpleasant quality, is such, then the mind works overtime to resolve the conflict internally. It thinks of, it allows itself to cast its energy in the form of imagination. It says, I can't handle this. I've got to find a way out. Since there's no way out, I'm locked into this pain for whatever reason, I'm going to just work overtime. I'm going to work overtime both in terms of casting and distracting myself away from it, but also in terms of my fear response and what it's going to become if I don't do something dramatically to change it. And so the fear response begins to become the reality and the actual physical sensation, the distant relative of that reality. And the fear response becomes so clear and so true that we're really no longer in touch with the physical sensations any longer. The physical sensations, if they're felt, are just the breeding ground for further reaction and fear, not for any invitation for relaxation. So we take our mind off the physical sensation and we place it on the fear response. Now we're dealing with fear. The fear is what we're dealing with here, and we're learning how fear is always an extrapolation, not of what's occurring now, but of the tragedy of the dead end of the train wreck that is going to occur unless you have an amputation for this terrible pain. So you begin to see that the real problem is the futurizing, the imaginizing? Right? And so you go, okay, so this isn't now. Let me figure out now. Let me figure out the bearing, the coordinates of now. Because what I've got is the coordinates of the future. That's where my mind is. It's not in the coordinates of now. What's in the coordinates of now? Certainly not the fear, because the fear is just the expectation of the now turning into, right? So now we're on to something. See, you're learning this. You're learning this by seeing your mind do it. You're not learning this by keeping your mind from doing it or by belittling yourself because you're getting lost in fear. You're learning from the reaction itself. So you have to be stronger than the reaction, or you're going to get embedded in the reaction rather than to learn from the reaction. Learning from the reaction teaches you about what is now and what isn't now. And when you learn the difference between that, you spend less time in the fear and more time in the patient acceptance of the unpleasant quality. And in that patience, there actually comes a time when it isn't laced with fear. And you begin to see that the differentiation of me wanting anything has always been in the extrapolation from now. And when we are no longer taking or wishing then the abiding in now can be done even in the midst of pain. So that's a long, okay, so be patient with that process. Just go to it and be as patient with it and keep your eyes as open as you can. And learn, oh God, and watch what's ever behind you. Because what's behind you is creating the differentiation. If you bring out what's behind you and put it in front of you, you'll begin to see the differentiation. And you do it very gently, and you do it very patiently, and you do it with extraordinary self-kindness. Because anything other than that means that there's something behind you driving you. Yes.
Could you talk a little bit about staying embodied while experiencing free falling, about changes, about the way you knew yourself, you no longer know yourself, or on the inside or the outside, the work that once was alive isn't, like you don't know exactly what coming. That sort of sense of how to
right.
Stay grounded when
you don't know. Right. Okay, so let me reframe that, Christine. You tell me whether I've got it close. How do you stay embodied when you don't when your life is changing significantly, so that the old ways don't work anymore and you haven't yet discovered the new ways?
Right, but because of these teachings, I don't want to just grab onto something.
No. Right. So how do you stay in the free fall? How do you stay in the free fall of that experience, right? You very good question, because all we see is the fear of it, don't we? How do you develop an appetite for free falling? Well, because there's two sides of that coin. One side of the coin is the fear of the unknown. The other side of the coin is the joy of the mystery. And you can't have just one side of the coin. The coin keeps flipping on you. But you realize that to take your eyes off the fear of the unknown means you're going to miss the enticing, enriching vitality of the mystery. So you keep your eyes both ways. So it flips like a, right? And so sometimes you're afraid. It's like death. I'm dying. And sometimes you're caught in the physical fact of you're not going to be around anymore, and you don't know what you're going to be after you're not around. And the incredible adventure that you're on in dropping the body. And you'll see sometimes and soon, the bird wing. You know the Rumi's poem about the bird wing? The bird flaps its wings open and flaps its wings closed. If it was always open, it couldn't fly. If it was always closed, it couldn't fly. But the fact that it moves its wing back and forth allows it to raise up from the earth. There really is nothing to fear in fear. And in the bird wing, there's nothing to fear in the contraction of the wing. And we learn that.